Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community. This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine, bringing you a breaking news bulletin. David Bittner from the Wildlife Institute in Ramona, the eagle expert whose research was used to justify building several major wind energy projects and the Sunrise Power Link, has been sentenced in federal court for illegally taking eagles and repeatedly failing to turn in data on birds of prey that he banded and fitted with transmitters. The federal prosecutor argued that Bittner was more concerned about his own economic gain than the birds' well-being. Bittner was fined just $5,000 and granted probation, under condition that he turn over years of missing data to the government. Donna Tisdale, a representative of Protect Our Communities Foundation that is sued to block wind projects that relied on Bittner's data, praised the Justice Department for prosecuting Bittner. However, she believes the sentence was not severe enough. She said, "When unethical and basically corrupt experts like Bittner side with industry over avian protection, our beautiful birds literally get clobbered with the blunt end of the turbine blade." Bittner has been paid more than $600,000 in consulting fees from corporations, including Sempra Energy, Iberdrola Renewables, and Pattern Energy. He provided study data to the companies, but refused to turn it over to the government. Those reports were used to justify building Ocotillo Wind and the planned Tule Wind Project in McCain Valley in East County, as well as the Energia Sierra Juarez Wind Project in northern Baja, Mexico. In each of these projects, Bittner concluded that the wind turbines would not pose serious threats to eagles, although portions of these projects have long been considered eagle habitat. The sentencing memorandum reveals that Bittner had a long history of noncompliance with federal and state laws in multiple states. According to some witnesses cited in the memorandum, 90% of eagles fitted by Bittner with transmitters died within 1 9-month period. Other experts said there was no scientifically valid reason for attaching 2 transmitters to certain birds. Bittner previously had his license revoked by state and federal authorities in Ohio after he was convicted of illegally taking turkey eggs and arrested for possessing birds of prey without a permit, and yet he continued to illegally catch and band birds. He lied to probation officials and falsely claimed recently that this was the only time his permit had lapsed in 48 years. In fact, he had no active permit for 17 years from 1980 to 1997, the government contends. He reactivated his permit after moving to Ramona, but has had no valid permit in California since 2000 due to failing to turn in much of the required data. This includes data on dozens of eagles tagged and fitted with transmitters in San Diego and Imperial counties. Bittner has also been illegally using wild raptors or birds of prey in educational programs that are open to the public at his Wildlife Institute in Ramona, which hosts the popular Hawk Watch program each year. In addition, he was found to illegally possess 4 freezers full of dead birds, including migratory birds and golden eagles, some dating back years. In addition, Bittner conducted a helicopter survey of eagle nests in Joshua Tree National Monument, even after being denied a permit for use of helicopter due to fears by authorities of disturbing the birds. Bittner has balked at turning over transmitter data to the government, claiming this is proprietary information to be shared only with his corporate clients. He has claimed he had no time to apply for the required permits, though a wildlife biologist, Edie Harmon, has informed East County Magazine that the process is not time-consuming. Bittner's lawyer claimed he wants to retire and seeks to protect the birds and does not want the public to know where nests could be. His attorney also contended that no birds have been harmed by his efforts. That point was flatly disputed by prosecutor Melanie Pearson with the U.S. Attorney's Office, who said that birds have been harmed by Bittner. Even after pleading guilty to federal charges, Bittner sent a fundraising letter to donors asking them to support his nonprofit Wildlife Research Institute's education programs and eagle research to help agencies, quote, make sound scientific decisions regarding wind, solar, and other development projects. His fundraising letter to donors failed to disclose his guilty plea on federal charges or his lack of permits to conduct eagle research or even operate the educational facility. Bittner told East County Magazine that he did submit data on 600 bands more than what the authorities have on record. He said he and his wife raised funds to buy Ramona grasslands and sell the property to the Nature Conservancy as raptor habitat, where bald eagles are nesting. Despite pleading guilty to the federal charges, however, he insisted that, quote, everything we do is standard operating procedure. After his sentencing hearing, Donna Tisdale, who also chairs the Boulevard Community Planning Group in the area where Tule Win is planned, said that it's time for agencies that approved this project and others relying on Bittner's research to re-examine their findings. She concluded, perhaps it is time to review all his material and its validity. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine. Today I'm here again with Donna Tisdale, the chair of the Boulevard Planning Group. She was the recipient of the People's Microphone Award from KNSJ, and she's known as the Backcountry Warrior. Now, Donna has started a nonprofit out there, founded the Backcountry Against Dumps. She's on the board of another big nonprofit, the Protect Our Communities Foundation, and she's been battling big energy projects. Donna, we're very pleased you could join us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Miriam.
Now, your community of Boulevard has been targeted for more large energy projects than I think any place I've ever heard of.
Me too.
Give our listeners an idea here. How many industrial-scale energy projects are proposed for your little rural area there?
Well, it keeps fluctuating. We had 5 industrial wind and I think 6 or 8 industrial solar, and several of them are thankfully going away and others are still in the wings. So it's a lot.
These are large projects. Some of these are thousands of acres, 100...
30,000 acres, 1,500 acres, 4 solar projects altogether, Soitec Solar. It's a lot.
Yeah. What are some of the major issues, in your view, from these types of industrial-scale projects in what up until recently was considered a rural or agricultural area?
First of all, we spent about a dozen years with our community plan, our general plan update, and we thought we had succeeded because everyone agreed that because we have only volunteer fire, we don't have any imported water, we don't have a sewage system, that we should stay rural. And they changed a lot of the big ranches to 1 dwelling unit per 80 acres. We thought we were safe. Well, then the renewable energy boom came. Absentee landowners bought up the big ranches, and big industry from all over the world focused on our community for wind and solar.
Part of that was because this area was designated a federal energy corridor when Sunrise Power Link went through there. Are there other factors for why your particular community has been targeted with some of these reports, looks like 10, 12 different monster projects or more?
It's the willing absentee landowners. We've got Hammond Companies, which is a big developer in El Cajon. A lot of people remember them. We've got Greg Lansing of Lansing Companies, and he's now put his ranches up for sale for about $26 million. He was hosting Enel for Jewel Valley Wind. That's now gone, thankfully.
So Enel pulled out voluntarily. Why do you think that this big energy company decided not to go through with its industrial wind project in Jewel Valley?
It was the involvement of the community and the planning group doing our research and putting the information forward, and county staff actually supported us and said that South Interstate 8, it was too highly parcelized to allow industrial wind close to homes.
Now, you've also had projects proposed on tribal land and on federal public land out there, Donna. Tell us what the status of those are.
On tribal land, recently, thankfully, the Campo Band's General Council voted down Chaluk Wind, and that was proposed by Invenergy out of Chicago.
Now, this is a project where the tribe's initial wind project that they have out there has caused a lot of problems, I understand. You had stray voltage 1,000 times normal coming up through people's floors, into their houses. What are some of the other problems that industrial wind can cause for the residents and for the wildlife?
Well, in our community and other communities that are in similar situations, personally, we've documented infrasound in the homes of tribal members that live adjacent to the Kumeyaay wind turbines. And we've also documented in the home of several residences between 2 and 3 miles away from the turbines.
Very disturbing. Now, I guess the grandfather of all these projects, so to speak, is the Tule Wind Project, which has been approved by the federal government. I believe there's still some state approvals pending. But this thing would go into the beautiful McCain Valley, and that is an area that up until recently was protected. It's the gateway to multiple federal wilderness areas. How do you feel about this land being opened up for industrial-scale wind turbines 500 feet tall?
It's a travesty to redesignate protected public lands that were prized recreation area for its wilderness qualities and just to get out And also, they're allowing turbines within a designated off-highway vehicle park for the first time, and within 800 feet of several campgrounds. Eagle Nest, they reduced the project because of eagles, and now the eagle expert that was on it has pled guilty to felonies.
David Bittner. What did the court find that he did?
The sentencing memo went into great detail and said he had taken eagles without permission. He had done a lot of work and had not followed through in providing the data to the agencies.
So he took eagles without permission, didn't turn in data on these eagles. And yet, this is the expert that was hired by the energy company, whose report the federal government accepted in saying that it was okay to put this project out here in what historically has been considered prime eagle habitat. How could that happen?
Because that's the nature of the beast. We see these green energy projects getting a free pass on virtually everything. The lobbyists, the administration, our state government, the mindset is that if it's wind or solar, or if it's a power line that supports wind or solar, that nothing matters and they should just be allowed in regardless.
Now, in Altamont, thousands of eagles have been killed by these industrial wind turbines. So it's certainly a serious concern for people that are concerned about the wildlife in our region here. But there's a bigger danger for the people of our region, and that's the danger of fire. What can you tell us about the fire risks that this project may pose, because it's going into a one-way in and one-way out valley?
Iberdrola, the Spanish utility that is the developer of Tule Wind, they've had multiple fires at other projects, wind turbine projects, but when they speak to decision makers, they always downplay that. Oh, that's a rare event. But when you do the research, well, guess what? They've had fires all over the place. Sometimes it's a lightning strike, sometimes it's a faulty turbine, but they don't ever really come out and explain what the details were. They also lost a hole in Rugby, North Dakota. They lost the whole rotor top with all of the blades fell to the ground.
Wow.
And do we want that to happen in our public recreation area next to a campground?
We've already seen it happen out here at the Ocotillo Wind Project just a month or so ago. They had a multi-ton blade fall off onto a trail.
And we had the still unexplained Kumeyaay wind turbine self-destruction back in 2009 where they all blew up. And they had to replace all the turbines, blades, and all of the electronics. And we've never had that explained to us. The blades are still laying on the ground.
Now, you have a lawsuit that your organization has filed, I understand, trying to stop the Tule Wind. What is the basis of the lawsuit there?
Well, it's for a variety of things. Failure to address the noise impacts on people and wildlife. Violation of the Administrative Procedure Act, National Environment, NEPA, Endangered Species, I believe. We've got multiple lawsuits, so don't hold me to this because sometimes I get them confused. We've got lawsuits against Ocotillo Wind also.
Now, Ocotillo is an interesting case study out there because it seems like many things have gone wrong with that project that people who were watching it on the ground there, photographers and experts, had predicted, you know, what happened, some of these issues with the construction, with flooding, with diverting drainage and causing flooding in the town, flammable chemicals, turning it into a dust bowl, flashing lights, noise, all these issues that are very problematic, and also going right over sacred Native American burial grounds. It's interesting that the Native American Heritage Commission actually found that the federal government erred and should never have approved that project. They said what part of it was a sacred burial ground for 10,000 years didn't the Bureau of Land Management get?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. With the same thing happened with the Sunrise Power Link. They didn't even start consultation with the tribes until after they approved the project.
Now, I was out in McCain Valley and went along with one of the forensic dog teams the tribes hired, and they were alerting on, you know, ancient remains out there as well. How significant is that area?
McCain Valley, I have been told by experts that know, including a retired Bureau of Land Management person, that this was his field. McCain Valley has very high concentration of resources and culturally significant, but it hasn't gotten the attention of the Native American groups that Ocotillo did. I know that Manzanita Tribe and others did oppose it, but I believe they reached an agreement with the BLM.
Very interesting. Now, it's been said that the Ocotillo Wind Project is perhaps the most studied, the most photographed, the most documented ever in the history of a construction project for an industrial wind project. Actually, a couple of our photographers who are out that way and won the Saul Price Journalism Award for responsible reporting on that project. Now, I understand, Donna, that you've been in touch with them and they've been out here taking some photographs in your area as well. Is that true?
Yes, we've been working together since that project was proposed because I wanted them to know what our community had already gone through and the lessons we had learned.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, the community stepped up and they provided all kinds of information. That project never should have been approved.
Now, do you think that the Enel pulling out, do you think that community opposition had something to do with that? Were they a little bit fearful, perhaps, of the level of scrutiny and legal opposition that they might face if they were to come into this area?
They tried strong-arming our community planning group. They made allegations that we had made threats against them, the NL representatives. It was bizarre. But we challenged that, and they didn't come to our meetings anymore, and yet they were still in town. So it was a very strange situation. I don't understand it.
Interesting. What do you think the best options are for halting the Thule Wind project, if it can be halted at all?
I think that may be one of those projects that self-destructs.
You mean that it may not be so much a court ruling as it could be that the developer themselves has reason
to
pull out?
Yes, we had a similar thing happen with the Campo Lampa project. It was approved, but then the developers went bankrupt and 44 RICO charges against them. So Iberdrola, they haven't been able to get a power purchase agreement. Wind is very expensive right now. Natural gas is keeping prices low. And so they haven't been able to get a power purchase agreement. They don't have their permits for their turbines they want to put up on the Weipai tribal land, which has 7 or 8 active golden eagle's nests. They haven't gotten their permits for the turbines they want to put on the State Lands Commission land. They're waiting on some issues, too. So they've got a lot of outstanding issues, and I'm not sure that one's going to go.
Interesting. What about your public officials at the local, state, and federal level? How have they weighed in on this project and these issues that you're facing?
Diane Jacob has been there for us on each one of these projects, been very good, our county supervisor. Congressman Hunter, our district was split previously by Filner's office and Hunter's district, and both Congressman Filner and Congressman Hunter were helpful and wrote letters of opposition.
What about Congressman Vargas, who's now taken the seat formerly occupied by Filner?
I have reached out several times and tried to set an appointment, and I haven't gotten responses back, so I'm not sure. I need to push a little harder, but he is our congressman. This is a major issue, and he should.
Yeah, we've asked about that, too, and we haven't had responses from his office on this issue either, so I'm not sure why, and we would certainly welcome an interview with Congressman Vargas if he would be willing to come on the show and talk about this.
This is a major issue in East San Diego County and also in his district in Imperial County, where at least 20,000 acres of productive farmland has been industrialized with solar. It's a tragedy.
What can people do out there who have concerns, either actions that you recommend that people take?
Just keeping the decision makers and our elected officials informed. Governor Brown just fast-tracked Soitec Solar's 80-megawatt rugged solar and 60-megawatt Tierra del Sol solar in our community. And that basically would have violated our constitutional rights by denying us the right to go straight to state court. It would have made us go straight to the Court of Appeals, and we would have lost that. Unequal protection under the law is what we're seeing. A violation of our constitutional rights, our property rights, our individual rights, everything.
And if this could happen to Boulevard, they can just gut a community plan like that for these big wind, big solar. Could this happen to other communities across the county, Donna?
Well, that's why we filed a lawsuit against the county over the wind ordinance, because they did gut our community plan, and that would also allow the solar projects. And yes, it's happening in other communities.
Solar, can go almost anywhere. Unlike wind, you don't have to have high wind resources to bulldoze.
Knowing what I know about wind, I would oppose it anywhere. It's inefficient, expensive, and unnecessary.
Interesting.
It's very dangerous for people and wildlife, and you have to have too many roads and too many cables, mm-hmm. and it just disrupts everything.
What are some of the problems with the industrial-scale solar projects?
It's a matter of concentration and the size and the scale of these projects, and there's basically been little research on the impacts to people. We've got a 60-megawatt, that's 60 million-watt solar project directly across a country road from people's houses.
So
on 500 acres.
So you're concerned there could be electromagnetic
radiation? There's going to be electromagnetic radiation, probably stray voltage. There will be noise from the inverters and transformers, likely low-frequency noise. Even be infrasound.
How large are these things?
And glare. These Soitec Solar, they are 1,200-square-foot panel each. All four projects in our community are a total of about 47 super Walmart centers.
Wow. I was at that meeting where one of the representatives came in, and you asked about glare, and they swore up and down that these things wouldn't put out any glare, and you had these photos you'd taken of an identical panel of theirs, I believe somewhere in La Jolla. It certainly looked like a lot of glare to me.
It's a huge amount of glare. In fact, the Soitec solar project, these are experimental. The first one just went in at Newberry Springs near Barstow. It's a 1.5 megawatt, and because of the outcry from the community, San Bernardino County had put a moratorium on solar projects because of that project.
These are also going into wetlands, and now they're finding with some of these, even out in the desert, that all of a sudden they're getting water birds attracted to these things. I guess it looks like water from the air, and they're having bird kills of things like pelicans and birds they didn't even expect to find out there. How big an issue is this with them going on to riparian areas?
Well, bizarrely enough, they're looking at straddling Tule Creek and allowing these modules within the 100-year floodplain. They said they'll just make them 10 feet taller in the floodplain.
Unbelievable. I know we interviewed one resident out there, this poor old guy who retired out there, and now his house is going to be surrounded on three sides by these things just 200 or 300 feet from
his
doorstep.
Well, the other thing is the cultural resources. I mean, the Tule Creek floodplain was, that's where the Native Americans gathered, you know, when there was water there in the old days, and it is a floodplain now. You walk that area and you just, there's evidence of their presence everywhere.
Now, obviously, there's concerns among many people about climate change and the need to shift to renewable resources in an era of diminishing fossil fuels and increasing concern about greenhouse gases. What would be your answer to those who say that we have to have these large-scale renewables in order to save the planet?
Well, then why is SDG&E saying that they have to have gas-fired power plants to back up these large-scale renewables? Mm-hmm. They say it's because they're unreliable and intermittent.
Is there a better option? I mean, I know you yourself have a small-scale, old-fashioned windmill at your own house, so you're not anti-renewable energy.
No, but I think the answer is distributed generation, self-generation.
So small-scale projects.
Small-scale projects, close to where the energy is used. The number one is energy efficiency and conservation. Mm-hmm. Use less energy. We need to find ways to use less energy and more efficiently. If we are going to use natural gas, then maybe we should use fuel cells that are more efficient and can actually create hot water that can be used on the premises. There's a lot of answers that are still in the wings. We don't know. But why destroy beautiful backcountry and desert landscapes and rural communities, neighborhoods, when we could be doing it smarter, better, or cheaper?
Well, there you go. And there's options like vertical access, the little small-scale wind turbines and rooftop solar, lots of other things that can be looked at as options here besides these massive industrial-scale projects that are truly going to transform the face of East County and forever destroy
a lot. Well, the other thing you have to look at is rates. For every large-scale project, you have to have a new transmission line or a new substation. ECO substation in East County is $435 million.
And now are they proposing additional power lines, Donna, beyond what's already been
gone in? According to the long-term transmission planning, they're talking about one or two more 500 kV lines through the backcountry and the Cleveland National Forest. It's crazy. It's craziness.
Well, Donna, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. And if people want more information, is there a website that they can go to?
There's a website. We're all volunteer, and we're trying to get it back up, but it's www.protectourcommunities.org.
Very good. And you can also find a lot more information at eastcountymagazine.org in our Green Living section, where we're regularly updating these situations out there.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interest, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member of www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is a breaking news alert live from the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service.
An important meeting is set for Wednesday night, August 14th, on the future of fire services in the Rural Fire Protection District, which serves many communities in East County. The County Fire Authority is threatening to withdraw all fire service funding if the San Diego Rural Fire Protection District chooses to remain an independent fire district and not merge with the County Fire Authority. If the district stays independent, funding will revert back to 2007 levels, with no pay for firefighters for rural stations, according to a letter sent by the district's fire board to residents. The meeting will be held at 7 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday, August 14th at Old Ironside Park, located at 326 Harbison Canyon Road in El Cajon.
Rural Fire Protection District is the latest in a string of fire districts in unincorporated areas of the county to face takeover by the County Fire Authority. Some, such as Julian Quirmack Fire District, have opted against the consolidation and found outside funding to fill the gap, while others have opted for consolidation with mixed results. Ostensibly intended to improve fire safety in the wake of the Cedar Fire, the consolidation has had unintended consequences, including dark days and unmanned stations in some communities. The Rural Fire Protection District's board has issued a statement of options before residents. You can find their statement at eastcountymagazine.org. You can also find the county's arguments in favor of consolidation at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week's lineup of activities includes art, music, history, sports, nature, wine, and more. First up, tickets are available for a couple more days for the August 17th 6th Annual Heart of Mount Helix, with the emphasis on ART. This event, which runs Saturday night from 5:30 to 10 p.m., is a fundraiser to benefit the Mount Helix Park Foundation. The entertainment headliner is the Mighty and Untouchables. Other musicians featured are the Jan Connor Trio, Lillian Palmer, and David Maldonado. Besides the live music, there will be tastings from several well-known restaurants, visual art demonstrations, silent and live auctions, and a perfect sunset. Silent auction prizes to bid on include a bay cruise for 10 on a private yacht, lunch for 2 at Thornton Winery by way of helicopter to the winery, and the ultimate San Diego safari at Lions, Tigers, and Bears. Tickets for the 6th annual Heart of Mount Helix event are pre-sale only. Sales will end August 14th. The Young Actors Theater is presenting Grease, which opens this weekend beginning on Friday and running through Sunday the 18th. It continues next weekend from August 22nd through the 25th at Encore Theater in Spring Valley, evoking Rydell High's senior class of 1959 in this rollicking musical. The shows are at 7 p.m. each day, with Saturday and Sunday 2 p.m. matinees. Tickets can be purchased online at yatsandiego.org. San Pasquale Winery is offering a paint and palette event on Wednesday, August 14th from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Paint, sip, and enjoy. Find your inner Picasso as you paint and have a ton of fun. They provide everything you need, including a 16-inch by 20-inch canvas, supplies, art apron, and step-by-step instructions by a local artist. Just bring yourself, no art experience required. For more information and to reserve your space, go to paintandpalette.com. Also at the San Pasquale Winery's new tasting room on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa, enjoy live music featuring the Mercury Street Blues Band on Saturday, August 17th from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. They play a variety of music, jazz, blues, folk, and rock. Wine by the glass, cheese and crackers, and dessert are available. Seating is on a first-come, first-served basis. Mission Trails Regional Park in San Carlos will be hosting a summer twilight walk and owl prowl as dusk sets in on Saturday night, August 17th. Advance registration is required. Guests will gather at Bushy Hill parking lot across from the Kumeyaay Lake Campground entry. The walk begins at 7:30 p.m. and ends at 9:30 p.m. The Alpine Historical Society is holding their special presentation, Witness to Gettysburg, on August 18th from 2 to 3:45 p.m. at the Alpine Women's Club in Alpine. Miss Hattie Elizabeth Turner, played by Annette Hubble, tells how a town of 2,400 citizens coped with the 30,000 casualties following the epic Battle of Gettysburg. San Diego State University is set for Aztec Fan Fest, formerly known as Aztec Family Day, scheduled for Saturday, August 17th at Qualcomm Stadium. The event features Tailgate Town, a fan fest scrimmage, and a Meet the Team autograph session. Gates open at 3:30 p.m., and admission is free. The event begins with Tailgate Town, which includes appearances by San Diego State University players, coaches, and sponsors. as well as the San Diego State University Marching Aztecs and Cheer Team. At Cosmos Coffee Cafe in La Mesa, Jeff Berkeley and Jeffrey Joe will be performing on Thursday, August 15th at 7 p.m. Float in the pool while watching the family movie Brave this Wednesday, August 14th at the Salvation Army Croc Center. They call it Dive In Movie. The movie begins at 7:30 and the first 50 guests will receive inner tubes. The Croc Center is located on University Avenue in San Diego, just outside of La Mesa. Brouhaha Comedy has a comedy show every Wednesday at Haritna Mediterranean Restaurant on El Cajon Boulevard in La Mesa. The show runs from 7:30 to 9 p.m. This Wednesday's show features international headliner Kurt Swan, and the mixer starts at 6 p.m. with the show beginning at 7:30. On Tuesday, August 13th at 6 p.m., as part of their People Who Cook program, the Julian Public Library will be featuring frozen desserts with Jeff Jeremy from Jeremy's on the Hill. And a summer mixer where you can meet and greet with local businessmen and women in East County is hosted by the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce. The event is free for chamber members and $10 for non-members. The summer mixer will start at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 14th at the Holiday Inn, 8000 Parkway Drive. All of these events and activities and more can be found in our festival and events section and in our calendar at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice. KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. My guest today is Carl Calvert from the Board of Directors of the Motor Transport Museum in Campo. Carl is leading the museum's extraordinary effort to restore four of the original buildings at Camp Lockett, a leading California state historic park and a central part of America's military history. Carl Calvert, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Helen.
Now, the Motor Transport Museum is an all-volunteer group, and yet you went out and you purchased four buildings at Camp Lockett. And why did you do that? What is the significance?
We needed more space to store our vehicles in that was covered and enclosed. Most of our vehicles are kept outside. We're open to the public, and they come in and wander around and look at our vehicles outside. But in our efforts to continue to preserve these vehicles, we can preserve them much better if they're inside. And by purchasing these buildings and putting them in use again, then we can put some of the vehicles inside the building.
So in other words, you're going to become a permanent caretaker.
Yes.
Of a very important site. The county
right.
must be delighted.
Yes, the county previously owned the buildings, and they were not using them. They were declining in condition. They were boarded up. They even appeared to be blighted because they were not in use. And our interest in these buildings wasn't just to keep vehicles and collections inside of them, but it was also to be able to see them reused again and restore them and rehabilitate the buildings. So,
what was the original use of the four buildings that you purchased?
The Army built them in 1941. There was originally 25 of these buildings in Campo that housed the horses for the cavalry. The Army had a number of cavalry posts across the United States, but they wanted one in the western part of the country here, so they built this camp called Camp Lockett in 1941 to house the soldiers that later became known as the Buffalo Soldiers. And
the famous African-American
that's
Buffalo Soldiers.
Yes. Okay. And it turned out to be the last cavalry camp that the government had. Other ones were disbanded in earlier years, but this managed to survive. After the use as a cavalry, the county bought the camp They were originally used as horse stable buildings for Camp Lockett. There was 25 of them originally, and only four remain. But they kept the horses in these buildings. There was up to 58 horses kept in each one of the buildings. There was about 3,000 horses at this camp at one time.
My goodness.
Quite a few horses out there. The cavalry that was at Camp Lockett, they housed the African-American soldiers there, and they later became known as the Buffalo Soldiers, very famous soldiers.
Yes.
And they trained them on how to use horses, and there was large fields there in the area where every day they would take the horses out and train the troops on how to care for the horses and train them on how to use them.
Carl, I've seen these buildings. There's a forest of lumber in there. Back in the day when they used whole tree trunks to make beams and ceilings.
Yes, yes.
They're quite extraordinary looking. Do you hold a giant fundraiser? Are you getting any help for this big project?
Yes, we are getting some help for it. The county has been extremely helpful. We've applied, for example, this last year, we applied for 3 different grants. We were able to get approval on 2 of them. And we're slowly working on the buildings. The first thing we needed to do was replace the roofs to help preserve these buildings so they wouldn't leak. And we finished the first building, and we're now working on the second building with a brand new roof. And it's mostly volunteer labor that's working with me to rehab these buildings.
My goodness. Yeah. So you have a lot of skilled people with contract skills.
Yes, our membership is quite varied. People from all different trades. We have electricians, contractors, and people that are members of the museum.
Is the U.S. government aware of what you're doing?
I don't know that the U.S. government is. We applied for a U.S. government grant, and we were not successful in obtaining that. We've been more successful in getting grants on a local level.
Well, that's very heartening news. Do you have plans to open the 4 former stable buildings?
Yes. Once we get the roofs on them, we will address other issues like the electric windows. A lot of the windows were broken. They were vandalized at one point. People broke the glass out of the windows, and we'll replace the doors. But essentially, we're trying to rehabilitate these buildings so they look from the outside as they did originally, as much as possible. The inside has been changed a little bit because after the Army used the buildings, the county bought them, and they leased them to the Mountain Empire School District, and they put junior high and high school facilities inside the buildings. And that's where many of the local people went to school there years ago.
Then you must be making a lot of people in Campo very happy.
Oh, we are. Right. We get a lot of accolades, yes.
Carl, this is an extraordinary story, and I want to thank you for stopping by. And I hope you'll come again because we want to learn more about the Motor Transport Museum.
Good. It's
thank
my pleasure,
you.
Helen.
And thank you for listening to The Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
This is Iris Neal. Join us for Job Talks, bringing you news about great jobs and growing our regional economy.
Job Talks on KNSJ's East County Magazine show is supported by our listeners and by the nonprofit San Diego Building Trades Family Housing Corporation, building our future.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting for Iris Neal on today's Jobs Talk. If you are looking for a job or thinking of changing careers, you're going to want to turn your dial up and tune in and listen up because we have 2 experts with us today who are going to give you some advice about how times have changed and what you need to know if you're looking for a job in today's market. My first guest is Antonio Viana. He has a long background in human resources. He's an author, career coach, and educator. Welcome, Antonio.
Thank you.
Our other guest today is Raina Menashe. Raina is a social worker, author, and teacher who teaches a life skills class for people who are coming out of rehab or are offenders who've actually spent time in prison. And she helps counsel them, among other things, on what to say when you're looking for a job. So welcome, Raina.
Thank you.
The first thing I'd like to talk about is resumes. Now, if you're sending a resume out and you're not getting a response, there could be some good reasons for that. Antonio, what advice would you give?
So many companies are asking for applicants to send resumes electronically, either directly to somebody in the company or post it on a platform like either a Monster or the company's website. And when you post your resume electronically, most people don't appreciate that the resume is actually scanned through a scanner, which is a machine that actually looks at your resume and tries to identify key code words that it wants in your resume that aligns with the company's values and the job descriptions. So if you're posting your resume electronically, you have to make sure that your resume includes those key code words.
Fascinating. And how do you know what those are?
Well, the job description probably includes some words that really will stand out to you about the job, as well as really the company's culture. So without misrepresenting yourself, you need to include those code words throughout your resume so that the scanner, not a person, the scanner picks up on that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, your resume goes into a deep hole and you'll probably never hear from the company because, of course, a scanner won't respond to you.
Very good advice. Raina, how about you? What tips would you offer on creating the ideal resume?
My thoughts are more along the line of how can you make yourself look as good as possible. So if you have holes in your history, and just about everybody does, but some are more extreme than others, or areas that you're embarrassed about, or maybe you're concerned about ageism or something else, or there's a skill you want to de-emphasize, my point is to move the information around to highlight what you want highlighted and to de-emphasize what you want de-emphasized. So it's more along the lines of if somebody has not worked for a while or they have holes, how can they rearrange the information to tell the truth and yet highlight what they want
to highlight? So can you give an example or two of how you do that? I guess you don't have to have the resume in chronological order anymore.
So for example, you don't have to put the date that you graduated if you really don't want to point out that it was a long time ago. You don't have to put the same objective at the top of the resume. You can have different versions of your resume for different kinds of jobs that you're applying for. You can re-spin, while telling the truth, some time that you spent away from the work world. If you were traveling, whatever you were doing, you don't have to say it baldly the way that you might explain it to your best friend. And yet still, you must tell the truth.
I totally agree with that because the chronological resume where you give the years that you worked for certain companies may not be appropriate for many people. Therefore, you go to what is called a functional resume. You identify, as Rena has been saying, the key skills that you have, and you actually describe those skills and the accomplishments you've been able to arrive at using those skills. Therefore, you don't have to describe gaps. Mm-hmm. And I agree. We've all had gaps in our background that perhaps we don't want to share with someone else,
right,
or is very difficult to explain. So use a functional resume in that kind of situation.
And that can mean emphasizing the things that you are good at, your strong mm-hmm. points, the assets mm-hmm. and the values, and the things that you can bring to the company, the ways that you can help them.
Exactly. This resume, as we're saying, is really your calling card. It's saying who you are and what you can contribute to the organization for the company to solve its problems.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you're telling your story. I mean, Rena and I are both authors, so we know a lot about storytelling. But storytelling also means that you can tell the truth by editing out information of your life that is not relevant or appropriate for this particular job. And that's totally ethical, totally appropriate, totally legal.
And some of my clients say, you know, isn't that lying? And you're saying not to lie. But in the social work field or in the counseling field, we talk about reframing.
You gave an interesting example of that, the fellow that had been doing the cooking while he was in prison.
Right. There was a client who had done a lot of cooking while he was in prison, and he really loved cooking, and he wanted to go back to school, and he wanted to firm up that experience with a degree. And so we rearranged his resume so it really highlighted the number of people he had cooked for.
And in the state institution.
Yes. And it gave him the confidence, I think, to present himself better. And I want to mention another pet peeve about resumes, though, which is that if there are lots of errors on the resume, it really bothers me. I don't know if that's the writer in me, but
I would agree with that. You want to have somebody edit it. If English isn't your
right.
strong point, have somebody edit it who has those skills.
Right.
Yes. You're right. You want proper words, you want proper sentence structure, you want punctuation, and you want the resume to speak to the person who will be looking at the resume. For example, if you're an IT specialist and you have so many IT technical words or phrases that only IT people can understand, then your resume is not going to be very, very good. Or if you're coming out of the military And you talk about your military background using military lingo for a civilian job. That civilian company may not understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So know who your readership is and write your resume to that reader.
That's so true. I had an example of that myself. I helped a friend with a resume. He had done mainframe computers for large corporations. No job after 2 years of looking. And I looked at it and said, well, the problem is the resume is in geek speak. It was all the different programs he knew. I said, an HR person is going to want to know what that means and what you can do for their company. Have you ever saved the company you worked for money with everything you did? And it turned out he'd saved them a lot of money. So we rewrote it. Within a week, he had two interviews, and one of them turned into a very good job for him.
Well, that's great, and a great example of sort of knowing who your readership is and responding to the readership.
Now, something new that today's job hunters have to deal with that maybe my generation didn't need to is social networking, which can be a plus, but it can also be a drawback if the employer is reading about your wild and crazy past, or worse, your wild and crazy present on there. What advice would you give, Antonio, to job hunters about how to handle your social networking?
Well, social networking is really what it claims to be. It's meant to exchange social information with people of similar likes. What companies use social networking for is to find out opportunities to disqualify you from jobs mm-hmm. and disqualify you from their company. So you've got to be very careful about what you put on your social network page, even though you may think it's only going to your friends, your 5 million friends that you have around the world. It's going to more than your 5 million friends because that information is public knowledge. You have to be very careful about what you say, who you talk about, and about your background, because it will and can be used against you for a job search. My caution is be very careful. Twitter, Facebook are the social networks, but LinkedIn, which is more business-driven, you certainly want to be much more business talk and discussion and not have anything about your personal life with your LinkedIn account.
I suggest that you just Google yourself. Go on the computer and see what comes up. And you'll see that your history is there. And to realize that your fingerprint is on everything that you do. Keep that in mind when you're out there having fun, because it's not just for your friends, as Tony was saying.
Mm-hmm. And you may, if you have things up there that an employer might find objectionable, you may want to go on and take some of those party photos off of Facebook.
That's right. And also think about, going back to what you're saying before about the resume, we didn't discuss holes in the resume. Mm-hmm. I think that just like you might take photos down off Facebook, mm-hmm. you might think about what parts of my history do I not need to mention because it's not relevant. Again, it's not lying, because not everyone needs to know every piece of the story. You don't get all of the backstory. So if you don't want it out there, then it can't be out there. Mm-hmm. You can't have both.
And I also agree that even during the interview, when you're face-to-face with someone, if someone asks you a question that is not relevant to your ability to perform the job, a legitimate answer is to ask the question back, why are you asking me this? I don't see how it relates to my job performance. And you've got to sort of stand up and be bold about some things.
Would that be considered at all rude?
If a person is asking me something about my background that doesn't relate to the job, and they're nosy to that extent during the mm-hmm. face-to-face, that may not be the kind of company that I want to work for. Mm-hmm.
So you're interviewing them as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be a two-way process. But speaking now from an HR perspective, we do not like to have someone else control the interview. We want to control the interview.
Right.
So you're right. You have to be very careful about appearing to be very standoffish or tough or rough. But I think each of us have got to decide what we're going to share and what we're not going to share.
I think the bottom line is enthusiasm, genuine, authentic enthusiasm. If you have holes in your history, or you don't have much experience in this new field, or you're going back to school, or you're insecure for one reason or another, maybe you've been home raising kids and you're going back into the work world. If you're excited about the work for real, then they'll pick that up. Now, if you're not, that's where it takes more crafting and thought and repackaging so you can find something about it to be enthusiastic. Because again, I think people know when it's not authentic. I don't know, do you agree with
that? I totally agree. Is when you're interviewing someone who seems to be bored with about the topic that you're talking about, which is the job, and they're bored about what the company is about, its products or services, you begin to ask yourself, this person doesn't have any passion. And without passion, there's going to be boredom. And with boredom, there's going to be bad job performance. So you have to step it up. Or you simply don't interview for jobs and companies that you don't want to be part of. is simply wasting everyone's time.
Very good point. Back to the interview itself, how should you dress for the interview?
I think you have to dress for the culture of the company and for the job. For example, at one time, I was interviewing for a vice president of human resources position in a company whose culture was very casual, which means that people dressed in casual clothes, there were no business suits, there were no ties. But I didn't know that. So I came into the job interview dressed in a dark suit with a white shirt and a dark tie with shiny shoes. And people looked at me as if I didn't belong. And even though the interview occurred, it was a short interview, and I knew exactly at the moment in time when I was rejected. And that is, I didn't look the part. Mm-hmm. So therefore, again, know the audience that you're interviewing with and dress mm-hmm. for the audience's success. Don't dress the way you want to dress.
This is relevant with tattoos and piercings. Something may be part of your personal style, but it may not be something you want to show up front. So I think if you have a lot of tattoos on your arms and things like that, you might want to wear long sleeves in the beginning until you see what the climate is, what the culture is.
Right. Unless you're applying to a tattoo parlor, that's probably wise advice.
Right.
What about the best places to find jobs nowadays? There's all kinds of electronic options out there we didn't used to have. Has the age-old advice of contacts count changed?
Contacts and networking count more than ever before. In the HR world, we call it shoulder tapping, which means that you know somebody who knows somebody who knows where there's a job opportunity. And that's really the best way today, unfortunately, where jobs get filled, is that you get to know somebody who knows where a job opportunity may exist or can introduce you to somebody who may be interviewing for certain kinds of jobs. So the idea of networking, become part of professional groups. So if you're an accounting person, join the accounting professional groups. If you're a human resources professional, join human resources professional groups to get to know the people who are in the profession that you want to be in, because your name will get referred to. I'm not saying don't submit resumes coldly, and I'm not saying do not respond to job ads, but the shoulder tapping and the personal contacts is paramount today.
And I suggest to students to hoard business cards. So anytime you go somewhere, you hear a speaker, those business associations you're talking about, get a business card from everybody and put them in one book. And then when you're trying to make contact and looking out there for a job, you know, email everybody and say, I saw you speak at this and that. It's more personal.
Yes, and passing out your own business cards is important too. I can say the best job I ever had was an editor I had met at a party, had handed her the card, never got any writing work from her, but she passed my card along the next day to someone who called asking for writers, and I wound up with a full-time editing job out of that.
That's an excellent example, because even though you're considering working for a corporation, you know, a large company or even a small to medium-sized company, where you'll get a business card from the company, having your personal business card with your name, your contact, and your functional area of expertise is really sort of paramount. Mm-hmm. And you know, Rena, I've always kind of wondered why students never ask us as faculty members for our business cards. They should be doing that on a regular basis, because we are experts in a certain area that they may be able to leverage down the road.
Mm-hmm. At the Honor Society, I do encourage them to get business cards from every speaker who comes in, but you're right, they don't usually ask us.
Well, thank you both for joining us here today, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come in and share your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. The other day I talked about a couple of plants that I've learned to hate over the years, and I've got a couple more I'd like to add to that list. Basically, I just kind of want to warn you off from planting them. One of them is a euphorbia. It's called Mexican cigarette tree. This is in the same family and very closely related to the sticks of fire. It's a very popular succulent because of its orange color. People love sticks of fire. The lucky thing about sticks of fire is it doesn't get enormous. The bad thing about Mexican cigarette tree is it's the green version of the same plant, and it gets huge. It can easily get to be 8, 10, 12 feet tall. As it gets taller, even if you're not watering it, it fills with that milky euphorbia sap.
That sap is incredibly dangerous. My husband and I were removing some of those off the property that we bought a few years ago, and one of the branches broke and splashed some of that sap next to my eye. By the time I went straight up into the house to rinse it off, I had already raised a blister. I mentioned this in class the following week, and one of my students told me that he had been removing those same Mexican cigarette trees from his property, and he got it in his eye and had to go to the emergency room. They were not so sure at all that they could save his vision. So this is just not something that you want to have on your property, hopefully. And if you do have it away from where you might be walking. Children might be playing. You might be so close to it riding a horse or something that you would break off a branch and get that sap on you. Incidentally, the sap of euphorbias, it doesn't show on your clothes when it first gets on. It looks kind of like Elmer's glue. You won't find out that you got it on your clothes until you send them through the washer and dryer. That white sweatshirt that you got the white sap on is going to come out with huge blood stains down the front of it where that euphorbia stuff has dried. So watch out for that plant. Another plant that I wish they wouldn't sell anymore is called Vinca major. It is a periwinkle. It's not an annual periwinkle. It's a perennial periwinkle. And when I say perennial, I mean it will be here after the nuclear holocaust when nothing is left on Earth except cockroaches and rats and Vinca. So it's the pretty one that is vining, and it has a blue flower and dark green leaves, and it's just wonderful as long as you like it and as long as you're willing to give it lots and lots and lots of water in the summertime, then you can keep it going and it'll look decent. But will come the day, doubtless someday, when you decide you want to re-landscape, you don't want that plant anymore. Good luck. Probably the only way to get rid of it would be to pave over it with 6 inches of concrete. So, Vinca major, stay away from that. It's not a friendly character. One more that I'll just mention in passing that is a really cute plant that I've seen people make a lot of mistakes with, including one poor lady who planted it all over a slope as a ground cover and has lived to regret it, is the Mexican evening primrose. It has pink flowers. It's a little vining character that gets about 6 inches tall, and then the flowers stick up another 6 inches. It's very, very cute. It's also very invasive. When you change your mind and realize that it doesn't play nicely with the other plants that are in your flower beds, it's already too late. You have got it forever. I did find one perfect way to use this plant, and that is I have it in my orchard. I put it next to the drip irrigation around my fruit trees, and because it learns to love that drip irrigation, it will bloom right under the fruit trees and be delightful looking, and then it won't go all over the whole yard because it doesn't want to go where there's no water. So maybe next time I can tell you about some plants that are good plants for your yard.
This is Rebecca Williamson with East County Magazine live on KNSJ 89.1 in Descanso. Today, I'm here with Sierra Robinson, one of our interns. She's a senior at High Tech High School. She interned with us last year, and she liked it so well, she's back again. Sierra, tell us how your internship works.
Well, at High Tech High, juniors find their own internships, and they immerse themselves for a total of 3 weeks. Last year, I shadowed Miriam Raftery at East County Magazine and got an in-depth look at many aspects of journalism.
You wrote a number of stories on emerging green technologies. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I wrote stories about green roofs, solar roadways, and even flying wind turbines.
What other topics did you cover?
There were tons of fun topics, such as a restaurant review and fashions at a resale clothing shop. I also covered some serious topics, such as going to the scene of a search for a missing person and covering a judicial candidates forum.
What did you learn from the experiences as an intern at East County Magazine?
I learned how to post stories online, what it felt like to interview people, and it was just really exciting to learn about all these different things and topics that I never thought would be interesting to me. And every day was something new.
Where are you going from here?
I plan on going to Grossmont Community College for my first 2 years and then transferring. I'm hoping to major in creative writing or English.
Great. And now our editor, Miriam Raftery, is going to tell us about opportunities for any listeners who may be interested in internships.
We have opportunities for interns all over the place, part-time and full-time. We've had a lot of college-level interns,
as well as some high school ones. And as a nonprofit media outlet, we also welcome community volunteers. Our interns and our volunteers can get great experiences here, and some of them have actually gone on to win major journalism awards and land jobs in journalism careers.
Thanks. And for information on how to get involved with East County Magazine's award-winning online news and station KNSJ 89.1 from Descanso, contact the editor at eastcountymagazine.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.